Okay, how about now? Has that helped?
Yeah, he laughs there now.
Okay, that's great. So all right, without further ado, let's get going. So hello everybody, welcome to the April 2013 Results Conference Call. For those of you who I haven't met yet, my name's Aaron Oxley, I'm the Executive Director here at Results UK. I'm really pleased to say that the past month has actually been hugely busy and hugely successful for us with your ad results. We've had the They Go To Die advocacy tour, we've had World TB Day, and we've had a whole range of other activities going on as well. There's been so much exciting work happening. I really hope that everybody's been able to keep up with everything on our blog and all of our other social media channels so you can see what we and you all have been up to around the country. From a personal perspective, I've been really thrilled to see the level of media traction that tuberculosis has gotten over the last month, particularly tuberculosis in mining, but also just TB in general, and that's both here and in international media. Was particularly pleased to see that the Financial Times, which is a lot of important decision makers definitely read that one, they ran a four-page supplement entirely dedicated to the issue of tuberculosis. Articles there covered topics ranging from the fight against TB-HIV co-infection, problems surrounding TB in children, TB in mining, which was great, and of course the need for also funding vaccine research because the vaccine we have for TB is over 90 years old. Also, our own BBC made a note of the call from an international group of doctors and scientists for visionary leadership if we're to tackle TB effectively. So reporting on an article in The Lancet, the article highlights the growing problem of drug-resistant TB strains, largely as a consequence of complacent and neglectful governments worldwide. Time and the Wall Street Journal also both recently run TB stories on their front covers. So it's really, really heartening to see that this crucial issue is being picked up by the media. We all know that generating public and press support is one of the most important ways to generate political will. So all the work that Results has been doing on TB over the last few years is finally starting to bear fruit. So you should all feel really proud of being a part of that. Also, it's a real pleasure to see that we're continuing to grow as an organisation. Part of that growth, I'd like to welcome to the call tonight Tony Pippin. Hi, Tony. You may be on mute, so I'm going to keep talking.
Yeah.
So that's Tony, everybody.
Hi, Tony.
Tony's joined us at Results. It's his very first day today, so it's very brave of him to jump straight onto the call. Tony is our new fundraising officer. He's going to be focusing on trust and grants fundraising and chasing some nice big pots of money for us to expand our work. Tony brings with him a huge range of experience and over 20 years of fundraising in the charity and voluntary sectors. So we're really looking forward to working with him to ensure that our financial future is secure and our growth continues. So welcome, Tony. Lastly, before I hand over to Tom for some announcements, I just want to make a personal call for everybody who's here to come to our national conference. If you haven't yet signed up to join us for the weekend, then please do, because we'd really love to see you. The conference is always a real highlight on our calendar, and we always just have such a great time connecting with everybody face-to-face, learning with you and from you, and also, of course, socialising, putting faces to names, and so on. So if you are available the weekends of the 20th and 21st of April, then do get a registration into the team here in the office. So over to Tom.
Right, thanks for that, Aaron. We don't have a huge number of announcements to you today, so I'm just going to go over the national conference again and ask as many of you as possible to think about attending. As you'll know by now, the conference is taking place over the weekend of the 20th to the 22nd of April, which is only 3 weeks away now. We have an excellent range of speakers over the 3 days already confirmed for you. So on the Saturday, which is the 20th, will be a day of discussion and debate on the successes, failures, unintended consequences and potential replacements of the MDGs. We've already confirmed guest speakers that include John Hillary from the Executive Director of the War on Want, Matt Collins, founder of AgeSource Blog, David Sethaway from the Institute of Environment and Development, Shobha Das from Minority Rights International, Pushpanav Krishnamurthy from Oxfam and Jacob Ingle from the ODI. You can read more about our guest speakers on our blog. On the Sunday, we'll be asking attendees to create a systems charter and to voice their opinions on what they think a new development framework should look like post-2015. On the Monday, on our advocacy day, we have meetings arranged with Malcolm Bruce, Chair of the International Development Select Committee, Ivan Lewis, Shadow DFID Minister, DFID's Health and Education teams, as well as a trip to the Commonwealth Development Corporation to discuss microfinance. All weekend registration is a mere £25 and include lunch on a Saturday and Sunday. That's an excellent price for what promises to be an outstanding weekend of learning and advocacy. Every year, many of our volunteers tell us that the National Conference is the highlight of their campaigning year, so please get yourself along if you can. If you haven't yet registered, then don't worry, there's still space available. Also, if you're worried about the cost of attending the conference, just let us know. We have a bursary available for travel and the conference free, so ensure all those who want to can attend. I'm now going to hand over to Felix for some grassroots updates and to introduce the action.
Thanks, Tom. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
So it's good to be back on the call. So I'm here in South London with my home group, which is nice. Okay. So in terms of the grassroots, it's been a fairly busy month, as I'm sure you're all aware. As almost all of you know, the main piece of work that we've been doing over the past few weeks and months, which has kind of finally came to fruition over the past 30 days, was the UK-wide screening and advocacy tour of They Go to Die. Now the dust has settled, I'd like to think that the 2 weeks we spent on the road were a complete success. All of our 18 screenings were really well attended, and we've managed to get more than 1,000 action cards signed, and we've added hundreds of photos to our eye-catching online photo competition. With your help, we've engaged a whole new audience on the issue of TB and the issue of TB in mining. We quite literally could not have done all of this without you. You're the guys that booked the venues, that did the promotion, that got bums on seats to all of those screenings. So I really wanted to say a huge, massive, great big thank you to all of you for everything that you did in support of that work. You know, giving us a place to stay, showing us the sights in your town, badgering MPs, getting us on the radio. Whatever it was all thanks to you that the whole process was so enjoyable and successful. And it was a real pleasure for me and for Saoirse and for Jonathan to come and meet you all in your towns and to bring the issue of TB and mining to all those different people. We're currently in the process of sorting through all of the action card signees, and we will be passing on the names and email addresses of interested volunteers in your local area so you can get in touch with them about results, upcoming results meetings. During the tour, we did some really excellent media, some of which Aaron's mentioned, but we were on BBC Radio in Norfolk. Some of you may have listened to that. We did interviews with The Lancet, a piece in the Financial Times, and then several small and regional papers. And we also have a couple of really strong possibilities for future pieces of media. During the tour, we also met with around 20 top academics and researchers working specifically on TB and TB-HIV. To engage them on the issue of TB and mining and how they individually can become involved in helping to make change. Starting with adding their names to a sign-on letter which will go to DFID, calling on them to do more to tackle the problem. We also met with representatives from the DFID team, and we held a parliamentary briefing for a group of MPs which had some very clear next steps for them as they engage on the issue of TB and mining. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for updates about the next steps in that campaign. One of the next big things that we're going to be doing is working to secure a meeting with AngloGold Ashanti, the mining company from which the four men in the film were sent home from, to deliver the action cards and to push them to show the leadership that is needed in driving the regional response. The momentum on this issue is, there's just no question that it's building. Staff from Results recently met with the top official from DFID South Africa, who said that as a result of a raft of constituents' letters on the issue, Justine Greening has had to become fully briefed on the issue of TB and mining. And I think it's safe to say we know where those letters have come from. Also last month saw the coming together of many of the key agencies working together to tackle the issue of TB and mining, including the Ministers of Health from Lesotho, Swaziland in South Africa, representatives from the mining industry, the World Bank, DFID and others. They met in Swaziland for a meeting on the Southern African region's TB problem. One of the key things that they discussed was TB in the mining industry, And one of the results of the meeting was something that's called the Swaziland Statement, which is a high-level document committing resources and political will to tackling TB generally in the region, but also TB in the mining industry. In fact, at that meeting, DFID South Africa made a small financial pledge giving money to some very small-scale technical assistance projects. Even though the money they gave was small, it represents an understanding on the part of DFID that this is a huge problem that urgently needs addressing, and it gives us a good angle to continue our advocacy. So everything on that front is looking very good, and we hope that over the next few weeks and months, we're going to be able to make real change on this issue. It seems as though all the signs are pointing in the direction for us to see some real success. So once again, thank you, and I really do mean that. You are the ones that helped get this whole thing off the ground. Now we need to ensure that we build and retain momentum on the past few months' work. Okay, so I'm now going to just very quickly introduce tonight's action. So, as many of you will be aware, and I'm sure as many of you are thrilled, tonight we're launching our now annual fundraising challenge, Live Below the Line. As many of you know, this is the third year that we're taking on this challenge, and it's been a really important source of revenue for results in that period. As a small organisation, we do rely on the generous support that we develop during this campaign each year. Without the core funding that Live Below the Line provides, we simply cannot continue to do the work that we do. So we want to thank you in advance for any money that does get raised. That said, we don't ever want fundraising to get in the way of doing great advocacy and outreach to build networks of people who want to end poverty together. So if you don't feel comfortable asking people for money, then please don't feel under any pressure from us to do so. The beauty of Live Below the Line is that it works just as well as an advocacy exercise as it does a fundraising one. So make sure you're using it the best way that you can. This year, we're framing our campaign around our new campaign area of nutrition. Every year, millions of lives around the world are affected by malnutrition. This problem touches lives in every corner of the world and has huge implications for all of the other issues we work on. Hungry children are more likely to become sick and will not learn in school. There are many simple interventions which can be utilized to tackle malnutrition, and we at Results are working hard to ensure they get the international support that they need. To discuss this issue and how taking the Live Below the Line challenge can help those children, we have our very own executive director, Aaron, to talk to us tonight. So welcome, Aaron.
Well, thank you, Felix.
No problem. So because I've been out of the office and people have been out of the office, tonight the questions are all going to come from our Central London group. But that's fine because they're bright and so I'm going to hand over now to Tom, and he's going to give us the first question this evening.
Thanks a lot, Felix.
What is meant by malnutrition and how does it affect people? Also, how many people around the world are affected by the issue?
Didn't hear it, I'm afraid.
Did you not hear that? Okay.
No.
What is meant by malnutrition and how does it affect people? Also, how many people around the world are affected by these issues?
Two. That's a great leading question, and I think the first thing to say in response to that is that we really do need to understand what we mean when we say malnutrition, because there's a lot of different ways to be hungry. If you look at background sheet three, the third background sheet that we've distributed this month, you'll see that malnutrition actually breaks down to two main bits. There's undernutrition and then there's overnutrition. So overnutrition is the stuff that we're not too concerned about on the call this evening. That's people who are overeating and obesity and so on. That's really, for the most part, is a rich world problem, and increasingly becoming a problem in the developed world as incomes come up, but not actually the thing that's killing people in the developing world in huge numbers right now. What we're most interested in is actually technically called undernutrition, where people aren't getting enough food to eat. Now, undernutrition can further be divided into four different kinds of undernutrition. And the definition on these matter because we tackle these with different kinds of interventions. They have different responses. So the one that most people think of when they think of undernutrition is actually called, technically, is called wasting. And that's acute malnutrition. What wasting is when you have low weight for height. In other words, you have these children You sort of see them on the television during the disaster appeals and so on. Very, very skinny, sometimes distended bellies from this thing called kwashiorkor. This is the result of a severe shock when there's been either a gigantic flood that's destroyed all the crops in a region, or there's been a drought, or there's been some kind of failure of the monsoon, or there's been civil unrest and people have been driven out of their homes and away from their sources of foods and livelihoods. This generates wasting. Wasting is reversible in that if you can take a child who is wasted, you can give them therapeutic food and feed them back up again, and they will recover. Something that we don't potentially think so much about in terms of undernutrition is what's called stunting. And stunting is a result of chronic undernutrition. This is when day after day, week after week, month and potentially year after year, children or adults, but particularly children, are simply not getting enough nutrition. They're not getting enough food to eat. They're not getting the right kind of vitamins and minerals. What that results in is permanent and irreversible damage. People that don't grow as high, as tall as they could have, that don't have the muscle mass or the immune systems that they could have. This is actually really quite a huge problem because it lasts for the entirety of a person's life. And stunting is irreversible. If you miss the chance to grow when you're small because of a lack of food, that's not something that you can make up with later on in adult life. And of course, because of the effect that stunting has on people and the fact that that's long-term and it's developmental, this is something we have to have some sensitivity about when we're talking about it. Because when you're talking about a large number of people being stunted and there being long-term damage, you know, those people are out there in the world, and we need to be sensitive to that. The third kind of undernutrition is referred to as underweight, and that's where a child is low weight for their age. And that can be the result of chronic or acute conditions. That can be as a result of a short, sharp shock, or it can be the result of a longer-term lack of food. But the one that was also quite insidious in terms of undernutrition is actually called micronutrient deficiencies. And that's really where somebody could be getting a decent number of calories every day and could be growing potentially all right, but they could be having some big deficiencies of particular vitamins and minerals. And the two big ones that immediately spring to mind are vitamin A and zinc, because both of those, if you're short on vitamin A and you're short on zinc when you're small, those can really compromise your immune system's ability to fight off disease and cause lots of other problems because of that. And going back to the question, you know, how many people around the world are affected by these issues? The numbers are fairly dramatic. If we're looking at stunting, so this is chronic malnutrition to the point where, you know, where children are low height for their age, we're talking about 10% of all children. We're talking about 165 million children under the age of 5 are stunted. So that's actually, if you look at the number of children being born each year, that is, you know, we're looking at about 120 million children born each year. So 165 million children under the age of 5 is actually a very, very large number. We're also looking at the number of children who are wasted. That's 55 million and 112 million children underweight. So these are very, very, very big numbers. These are lots and lots and lots of children. We're not even yet talking about the effect of malnutrition on adults. So this is a huge problem. And the consequences of being malnourished are a lot more than being stunted or wasted. They often result in death. I mean, if we look at the causes of death of children under the age of 5, undernutrition accounts for basically 1 in 3. In other words, because a child doesn't have a lot of energy in their body or they don't have the right vitamins and minerals to have a good, strong immune system, they can be they can die from complications or other infections like diarrheal disease or pneumonia, even malaria, tuberculosis. Some of the things that we work on through other labels, you know, part of the contributing factors to some of the high death rates are undernutrition. So, you know, this is actually an incredibly serious problem worldwide that is causing a lot of misery and death and suffering in both a short-term and long-term way.
Right, just,
what are some of the interventions that can help tackle malnutrition?
Okay, so in terms of some of the interventions that help tackle malnutrition, they broadly fall into two categories. And again, we have to go back to definition, so I'm sorry about that. But it's important that we understand the difference between these, because it's actually quite critical. So what most people think of when they think about tackling malnutrition, what they're thinking about are what's known as nutrition-specific interventions. So those are the sorts of things like giving high-energy food to children that are wasted. You know, children that are acutely malnourished, they're in the middle of a drought, they've lost a lot of weight in a short period of time, and they need to get some high-energy, what's called therapeutic food, into their bodies really quickly to get their weight back. Or things like breastfeeding, or things like specifically giving micronutrients to children by giving them either zinc tablets or vitamin A supplements. So these are all called nutrition-specific interventions, and they're really, really critical because, you know, we can focus in on those, and we can be very, we can measure and count and track nutrition-specific interventions quite well. What we also talk about in the nutrition world are called not nutrition-specific interventions, but nutrition-sensitive interventions. And what nutrition-sensitive interventions are things that might not absolutely directly impact the nutritional status of a child or a household, but they're more structural, and they address the underlying determinants of undernutrition. So these are things like agriculture, food availability, water and sanitation. They're bigger and more structural issues that absolutely have an effect on a child's nutritional status, but aren't necessarily a direct intervention. Now, as you can imagine, if we're talking about things like agriculture being nutrition sensitive, we're talking about things where it's not just about planting more rice or more maize and making that available. It's about planting food that actually has proper nutrition in it. Sweet potatoes, which can be vitamin A enriched, which give vitamin A in the sweet potato to children and allow them to get additional nutrition. So that's a way of making agriculture more nutrition sensitive. And these can be really, really expensive. So, you know, we can be talking about nutrition-specific interventions, and we know how much those cost, but when you're talking about overhauling the entire global agricultural system to make it more nutrition sensitive, then you're really starting to talk about incredibly, incredibly large amounts of money, and where you need to start to talk about all different sorts of sectors coming together to fight malnutrition. And so there we're not just talking about aid money, we're talking also about developing country governments, we're talking about the private sector, we're talking about United Nations agencies, and a whole pile of other actors that can come in and help tackle malnutrition.
Great. Third question.
What is being done by the international community to respond to this problem?
So I think one of the things that's worth saying is that, you know, Results was founded in the 70s by Sam Daly Harris, and it was founded when he read a report by the National Academy of Sciences that said that we could end hunger within a generation if only we had the political will to do so. And he said, I know, I can figure out what political will is, I can generate that, and we can bring about the end of hunger. Well, here we are 30 years later, and it hasn't been done. What I think is really clear is that now, even so more than back in the 70s, we understand that hunger is linked to poverty, and that by tackling poverty, we're also tackling hunger. But besides all of that, I think there's also been some great advances in the areas of nutrition. And we definitely understand these problems even better than we did 30 years ago. So it's completely fair to say that we do actually now know how to solve these problems. So what's being done at the international level to actually take some of those solutions to scale and make them all work? Well, I think one of the most exciting things about this is that this has been a neglected area for the last 30 years. It hasn't been something where there's been huge amounts of success, particularly over the last decade, but that's changed a lot in the last couple of years. And one of the most promising things that's happened is this initiative called the Sun Movement. And what the Sun Movement is, Sun stands for Scaling Up Nutrition. And where Sun came from was a recognition that nutrition is quite hard, and it's more than just food, and it's more than just therapeutic feeding, and it's more than just micronutrient supplements. It's actually really complicated, and there are a lot of different moving pieces. And so what Scaling Up Nutrition does is it aims to bring together all the different actors that are involved in nutrition, undernutrition, and malnutrition, and galvanize them in the countries where the highest burden of malnutrition is to then actually come together and tackle this issue quite specifically. So if you haven't had a chance to look at this on the web, when you get off the call tonight, I'd highly recommend you do this. Jump over to the Sun's website. If you Google Sun Nutrition UN, you'll find it. Or if you want to write it down now, it's Scaling Up Nutrition, all one word with no spaces, .org. So go there and have a poke around on their website. Because if you look at the kind of different actors that are involved in Sun, we have 34 countries that have said they're going to specifically work to scale up nutrition interventions in their countries. So that's 34 countries themselves saying we are going to be working on this and putting our own resources into it. There's also a civil society network of organizations like ours who have said it's time for us to take action on this, it's time for something to happen. And there's a huge network of civil society organizations working on this. There's the UN system. I mean, there are three different United Nations agencies that deal with food and agriculture. And there's another couple of UN agencies that deal with children, like UNICEF. So they're all coming together. All these different UN agencies are coming together to make nutrition a priority in their work. Obviously, we have a bunch of donor countries that are also members of Sun. And the UK has done some really interesting work on this with the Hunger Summit during last year's Olympic Games, and with another Hunger Summit that's coming up on the 8th of June, which we're going to be talking a little bit more about. So there's a lot of good stuff going on from the donor side as well. And I think what's also really interesting is that for the first time, this whole network of different actors, many of whom are the usual suspects, we're also saying, you know what, agribusiness and business networks also have something to add here. We can all remember back to when agribusiness were completely vilified and they didn't have a very good reputation, and many big food companies still don't have particularly good reputations. But I think one of the interesting things about where the nutrition movement is right now is it's increasingly recognizing that you can't be serious about ending malnutrition in the world and ignore the private sector. You have to bring the private sector in and find ways for them to be really, truly, properly helpful towards ending malnutrition in the world. And it's actually really encouraging that they're coming to the table as well. So there's actually a huge amount of stuff going on globally amongst the international community to respond to nutrition. And now is probably the most exciting time that we've ever had in terms of being able to really get this issue on the agenda and get real meaningful work done on nutrition to tackle this big problem.
What work is Results doing to tackle the problems of undernutrition, and how will this below the line help?
Okay, so What are we doing to tackle undernutrition and how will Live Below the Line help? I think one of the things that I said right at the start was that there's lots of different ways to be hungry. And I think, you know, for those of you that have done Live Below the Line before, you'll understand that doing Live Below the Line teaches you a little bit about hunger. I don't know, I've done Live Below the Line a couple of times now, and the first year I did it, I made sure that I had enough calories. It was really important that I had enough calories because I didn't want to be lethargic and slow. So I made sure I had lots and lots of rice. I had a few potatoes. I had lots of really starchy carbs so that I'd have enough energy to get myself through the day. But what I didn't realize was that, you know, the human body needs a lot more than just carbohydrates to function. And at the end of the week, I wouldn't like to claim in any way that I was suffering from micronutrient deficiencies or anything serious like that. But my body definitely noticed the fact that all I'd been eating was carbs, and it really didn't like it at all. I think the next year I did it, I made sure I had different food. So being able to bring in slightly different food and slight variations of the diet, it was astounding the difference it made by how I felt at the end of the week. And really, to then be able to talk about that difference and use that in the context of talking about nutrition and undernutrition and malnutrition, it just gave me such a fabulous, a real visceral understanding of what so many hundreds of million of people are experiencing, not just for 1 week a year, but for every single day of their lives. And so I think above all, the crossover between the act of actually doing Live Below the Line and the issue of malnutrition is just so very, very powerful because, you know, it really does get you thinking in your own personal life and your own personal experience about what this is all about. And people can connect with food. So, you know, Live Below the Line is giving us a great opening to bring out some of these numbers about, you know, the tens of millions of children that are stunted and wasted and the sorts of things that we need to do in terms of micronutrient fortification, in terms of breastfeeding and in terms of therapeutic food and so on, to help make sure that these children are not hungry and are not losing out on life opportunities because of being underweight or stunted. So I think that's the first thing in terms of making the connection through to Live Below the Line. I think the other thing that is important for everybody to know is that, you know, this big hunger summit that's coming up on the 8th of June is an opportunity for us to actually call on the UK government and other governments around the world to actually start putting their money where their mouth is on undernutrition and malnutrition. So in that respect, results is partnering in two separate initiatives. The first is one that hopefully everybody's heard about. It's the IF campaign, which is actually a campaign here in the UK with quite a large number of other development agencies, all the household names that you've heard of, people like Oxfam and so on. And that's really enough food for everyone, IF. Now, IF has the IF campaign has a number of different arms to it. They talk about aid, they talk about trade, they talk about tax, land, transparency. And a lot of those things are really important for, if you remember your terminology, for nutrition-sensitive interventions. Yeah? So some of the structural stuff. So we absolutely support all of the different parts of IF. Where the rubber hits the road and where children are actually dying right now and where we can be putting in things to save them and to prevent stunting is on the nutrition-specific interventions. And so there, if you dig around on the IF website, you'll see that there's some IF-related asks that are around nutrition-specific interventions. So, you know, we're really focusing in quite tightly on some of the nutrition-specific asks in the IF campaign, and we're trying to make sure that those are definitely prioritized by the UK government and coming up in the June events, and that not only are they doing this you know, in response to this IF campaign, which is a one-year thing, but that actually the kind of structural stuff is put around it so that there's accountability mechanisms, so that there's ways for other countries to come along with the UK and build a bigger pot of money than we can make just by ourselves, and so that we can make this into a multi-year kind of a project that has some legs to it, that has some longevity, because, you know, we're not going to be able to get rid of hunger in just 1 or 2 years. It's going to take some time to get immediate nutrition-specific interventions scaled up, but also to make sure that those nutrition-sensitive interventions are flowing through too. So this is a multi-year kind of thing. So we don't want this Hunger Summit in June to be just a one-off. We want to make sure that it's got all the structures around to be multi-year. So that's the IF campaign. The second thing that Results is doing is that we're working with our other Results organizations around the world on this too. So we're not just doing this alone here in the UK with the UK government. We're also working with Results Educational Fund in the US, with Results Canada, with Results Australia, Results Japan, plus another couple of organizations as well, to make sure that we're able to get some good nutrition-specific interventions coming through from the US and from other donors, so we can build a big coalition around this and really make it a big, important international initiative. And I should say, and that's exactly what we're going to be looking at in a much more depth on with next month's action. So next month's monthly action is going to be going into a lot more depth on all this stuff and having some very specific policy and practical asks.
Great. Thanks for that, Aaron. We're now going to open up for questions, either on nutrition or any practical questions you might have on the below the line. Go ahead.
Hello, Jill.
Hi, Jill.
Hi there. I've just had a look on the IF website, and it seems to be very general. Where do you actually get at the nutrition stuff? So it can be quite on this specific thing.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So if you go to the IF website, and you go to, where are we, where's the, if you go to the issues and click on any of them, but say click on aid, so for those of you that aren't in front of a computer, grab your pen. The website is enoughfoodif, all one word, .org, and then click on the issues and then click on aid. And at the bottom of that page, there's a paragraph that says want to know more. And there's two PDFs there. Download Enough Food for Everyone IF Policy Report and Executive Summary. So those two documents are the detailed policy asks for the whole IF campaign. So you can see there exactly how they've calculated how much they think the UK should be giving to nutrition-specific interventions and nutrition-sensitive interventions and all of that. And I think it's important for us to stop for just 1 second, actually, and acknowledge, and in fact, I really should have started the call by saying this, but, you know, since we spoke last at the start of March, the UK government has done something absolutely tremendous, and I think we should pause for a second and acknowledge that, which is that despite all the pressure during the times of financial crisis, the UK government made good its pledge to give 0.7% of our gross national income in foreign aid. That is absolutely sensational. And I really can't speak too positively about our government for doing that, because they're doing that in spite of opposition from their own backbenchers, in spite of opposition from newspapers like the Daily Mail, but they've gone ahead and done it. And what that means in practical terms is that our Department for International Development's budget for financial year 2013 and 14, which starts in 4 days' time, is 2.9 billion, that's with a B, pounds higher than it was this year. So by doing that, what the coalition government has done has created some really, really impressive space for the UK to make some really big investments in some new and really powerful and impactful development interventions. So, you know, we are really planning and asking that nutrition be one of those things. So when you look through the IF policy documents, you'll see that they want, one of the big asks of IF is for the UK government to reach 0.7% of our gross national income on aid. We've done that. We've reached it. And so, you know, that does give us the space to be putting money into these really high-impact, nutrition-sensitive interventions. So to give you an idea of what that is in real numbers, you know, they're looking, a few different agencies have calculated, and this comes from a few different places, that the amount of money the world needs every year for nutrition-specific interventions, kind of the gap that exists, is around somewhere between $5 and $5.6 billion per year. So that's the total gap. And the F campaign's calculated that the UK's fair share is about £149 million per year, which, you know, sounds like a lot of money, but when you look at the size of DFID's budget going up by £2.9 billion per year, £149 million all of a sudden doesn't seem like a very big number. So, you know, I'd like to think that that's a floor and not a ceiling. And, you know, that should really be the minimum that we as a country are looking to invest in nutrition-specific interventions. So we're going to be drilling down into a lot more detail on these very specific numbers on next month's call, because that's going to be right before the June event. But I think, you know, I really can't emphasize enough how awesome it is that our government has prioritized aiding onto 0.7. It's totally and completely historic. And I would really ask everybody on this call, the next time they write to any UK politician for any reason whatsoever, the first paragraph has to be to thank and praise the government for doing that, because that is just amazing, and they deserve our support for that.
Aaron, it's Reg.
Yeah, go ahead, Reg.
Just to add to what you said, I were going through some old papers the other day, and there were papers from 1970, when they were talking then about the possibility of 0.7 as a goal. So 40 years later, they've managed it, but I have to say, they've managed it in a time of a very difficult economic condition. So well done to the government.
I think that's absolutely right, Reg. I think what this really shows us, though, more than anything, is that our approach, results approach of creating political will, is the right approach. I mean, this wouldn't have happened if we didn't have the political will to make that happen.
I agree.
Go ahead, Pete.
£9 billion was an increase from last year, is what you're saying?
That's right. So let me just pull the figures up in front of me, because I prepared them earlier. Yeah, here we go. Okay, so you can get all of this off the Treasury's website. So if you Google something, I think it's something like Red Book Treasury Budget 2013 UK. You'll get the whole budget in all of its glory. But the bit you want to look at is about the departmental expenditure limits, the DELs. And what the DELs are is that what happens in the Chancellor's budget is he says for each government department how much they can spend, and then they're allowed to spend up to that amount. So it's divided into two bits. The capital expenditure, that's like for buildings and, you know, cars and trucks and all, you know, big expensive capital expenditure. And then there's the operational expenditure for programs and administration. Actually, Pete, I think if you could pop on mute, I think I'm getting an echo from you. So if you look at the numbers, and these are all public, there's no secret on this stuff. It's, you just go to the Treasury website. For the Department for International Development, their budget for programs and expenditure in fiscal year 2012 and 13, which is just finishing up now, was £6.1 billion. And for next year, which starts in 4 days, it goes from £6.1 billion up to £8.8 billion, which is quite a substantial jump. And then on the capital expenditure side, it goes up from £1.7 billion to £1.9 billion. So a much smaller bump on the capital side, but that's probably good because we want a lot more money going into programs rather than into capital expenditure. So you know, these figures are, you know, right on the Treasury website. And as I said, this is a just the same way that the previous governments have found money for bank bailouts and wars, this government has chosen to find money for development, and they definitely need praise for that.
Yeah, I just wanted to check, in your previous paragraph, you said that the increase was 2.9 billion a year, but that's not quite true, is it?
I'm not sure what you mean. Did I do my maths wrong?
No, the maths is right, but it's a 2.9 billion increase in 1 year, not 2.9 billion per annum.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. So the expenditure in 2013 and 14 is 2.9 billion higher, but the year after that, it's around about the same number again. So it jumps up by 2.9 billion this year, and it stays at about that level going forward into the future.
Right, I just needed that to clarify that too. So thank you for the link and for the data.
No problem.
Anyone else?
Lynn Lithgow.
Go ahead, William. Or Lynn Lithgow. Who is up there?
Lynn Lithgow.
Yeah, go ahead, William.
I don't know how many people were involved in Make Poverty History, but certainly up in Edinburgh there were huge crowds. Do you think there is the same in passion and enthusiasm for this, which is every bit as important?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I mean, one of the interesting things about Make Poverty History was that it had a very, very simple kind of message, a very simple rallying cry. And some of the policy stuff was a bit tricky, but generally it was around more and better aid. Now, the IF campaign has equally simple top-line message, you know, we can have enough food for everyone. But if you look at some of the policy stuff, it's actually much more complicated than the Make Poverty History campaign. And I think that is making it a bit more difficult for the members of the IF campaign to kind of, if you will, sell it to the mass public in the UK. But I think, you know, in results, we've never shied away from complexity. Some of the issues we work on are complex. I don't think that should stop us from supporting IF in any way, shape or form. I really hope, and I'm certain, I know that the organisers of IF are absolutely planning for it to be as big as Make Poverty History, and for it to be something that really, you know, everybody that cares about development can rally around. So, you know, we're certainly hoping and planning for that to be a really big, powerful campaign. And I think it has a few things going for it, in that, you know, some of the things that the headline asks in the IF campaign are absolutely doable or have already been done by our government. So, you know, there's every chance that, you know, that it's lining up quite well with what the government's saying are its priorities as well, particularly on things like taxation and transparency and so on. So it's an exciting campaign. I think it's good.
Good, thank you. Will there be any notes in the 20th, 21st of April or on that subject, or is that being kept till the next conference call?
I'm actually going to hand back to Tom to answer that question. Tom, where are we at with IF and our national conference?
Well, just to clarify, what is IF going to be discussed at the conference?
Yes, and explaining to us how to get people behind it, because if it's left till May, it really is only about 4 weeks away, whereas a few more weeks, or even only two, might be helpful. But you might have enough on your plate.
The conference focus is going to be more on the MDGs and the post-2015 process, so we probably won't necessarily discuss IF in detail at the conference, but I mean the following week the action materials will be sent out for the May action, where we'll be going over all of that kind of stuff and all the activities that we'll have planned ahead of the G8 in June will all be part of the May action. So you'll have a lot more details about IF and what we're going to be getting involved with regards to IF and nutrition in those action materials. But I'm sure we'll discuss IF, and you can speak to me and Felix and everyone. I'm sure we'll be talking about it at that point if you want to know more and know more about how results are getting involved with it.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's Aaron here. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, Tom's right, and he'll probably kill me for saying this. I mean, we don't yet have a specific slot at the conference for that, but we might find a way of talking about it somehow, maybe over a coffee break or something, and certainly we can make sure that there's some of the key documents around things like the IF campaigns, policy work and so on, so that, you know, you can have a look at it there.
Super.
Can I just make a suggestion that there is going to be a big event in London on the 8th of June, and they're hoping to get 40,000 people there. So you might start planning for that, or turning up for that, because that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, we are planning on attending that and encouraging people to attend that who are around.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if you sign up on the IF website, you can sign up for the campaign and get all the stuff from them, which dovetails very nicely in with this, you know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's Aaron here. I mean, I think in addition, I mean, around that event on the 8th of June, I mean, I just finished off some budgeting work yesterday, so it's also looking like that we're going to be able to support some grassroots to come to London if you're not based here, around the June event, and do some work with your MPs and other decision makers around that event. So, you know, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag too early, but we're definitely getting involved, and we do have some funds to help support grassroots to come down and really get involved around the June event. And so, yeah, that's going to be very exciting. I'm just quite conscious of time.
Okay, should we wrap up there?
Let's go again. Just very, very briefly.
Yeah.
There used to be a very specific remedy made up of sort of chocolate paste. Is that still available and efficient?
Yeah, I mean, I can answer that one really quickly. It's good. It's a very good question, William. I think what you might be thinking of is a substance called Plumpy Nut. And it was actually made, well, is actually made from peanuts. It's kind of like peanut butter with sugar and with a handful of micronutrients all mixed through and sealed up in a sachet like runners have, long-distance runners, where they can, you know, rip the top off and just slurp it straight out of this little plastic sachet, foil sachet. That's technically called ready-to-use therapeutic food. You know, more acronyms and jargon for you. But it's treated in most countries as a medicine, even though it's a food. And that, frankly, has completely revolutionized the ability for aid agencies to combat wasting. So acute malnutrition, you know, short shocks, like in famines and floods and disasters. So yes, this exists. Yes, it's still being used. And yes, it's pretty awesome. And we need to make sure we have more of it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Cheers, Aaron. So I think we'll wrap up there. I'm conscious of time, if that's okay. So we're looking forward to seeing you all over the next few weeks. And thanks for all the work that you've been doing over the last month. The next conference call is going to be on Tuesday the 7th of May. We've all just finished taking the grueling Live Below the Line challenge, and we'll have a real appreciation for the importance of nutrition. As a result, and as Aaron mentioned, we'll be launching our big nutrition action for the year, which will focus on mobilising funds and support for nutrition ahead of the Hunger Summit and G8 in June. If you have any further questions about Live Below the Line National Conference, feel free to get in contact with me or Felix or Saoirse at the office. Enjoy the rest of your evenings, and be sure to get your feedback forms in as soon as you can.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Good luck with Live Below the Line.
Thanks. Good luck.
Feedback forms.